führen. Von dem her wäre es wichtig zu wissen, wer hätte denn gerne eine Übersetzung ins Deutsche, damit wir ein bisschen den Bedarf abschätzen können. Okay, wir werden eine kurze Zusammenfassung aufs Deutsche, werden das nur ganz kurz dann zusammenfassen, was auf Englisch gesagt wurde, nochmal ins Deutsche. Okay, so we will change into English now. The presentation will be in English and a short summary of everything into German. Welcome, we are happy that so many people came here today to the event about Ankerzentren in Germany, especially Bavaria. It's an event from Caravane, organized by Caravane, and we have different representatives of different camps today. My name is Rebecca Kilian Mason, and we will now give a short introduction of everyone who is here. Then we will have a short presentation about the topic in general, about the situation within the last years. And then we will have three different blocks where we will focus on the general living conditions. The people will tell us what is the situation. Then we will go to the situation of police and security and the problems people are facing there. And in the end, we will focus on how people try to organize themselves, how they try to improve their situation and how this is going or what are the problems with that. After each block, we will make a short round to open it for everyone to ask questions or give his own experience. But in general, we will have to keep everything quite short because there's a lot of topics that have to be mentioned. So don't be mad if I have to cut you short, sorry. And if we cannot take every question or every comment, yeah? So, welcome. We will start with the introduction now and then go into the conversation.
Good evening, everybody. My name is David Jassy. I'm from Donovan. I'm also an activist, a refugee activist. Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Betty from Ingolstadt, so thank you.
Good evening, everyone. I'm John Jerry from Focasiani in here in Munich. Thank you.
Hello, Aino Kormensyre, researcher and activist.
I'm Samba from Refugee Struggle for Freedom in Munich.
Okay, and now at the beginning, we will get a short presentation from Aino. She is doing research on these anchor centers and camps, and she will give us her experience and impressions.
Yeah, hello, everybody. Welcome, and thank you very much for the invitation. It's great to be here on the podium with all of you. Thanks for you taking the time for coming here, and thanks for organizing this event on a very timely issue. I'm going to talk about anchor centers, but from my perspective, the perspective of my work, and focus really on the policing issue in these camps, what I define as policing of the deportation gap and as legal violence. And just to introduce myself a little bit, what I've been doing, I've been going to these camps since 2017, so probably there are many among you who know these camps much earlier. And my work has been going to two directions. I've been doing ethnographic field research on state violence, which affects failed asylum seekers in these camps. And secondly, also, I've been involved as an activist in legal support campaigns for victims of racist police violence and security guard violence, mostly in Bamberg, Donauwörth with David Jassy, and in Elvangen. Elvangen is, of course, not in Bayern, but very similar issues affect these big mass camps also in other states. And I've been working mostly with asylum seekers from West Africa, and majority of them are men, so they have who have some sort of deportation order issued against them. So this is a specific group also who experience very specific patterns of racist criminalization, black men without documents in Germany, police and security guard violence being definitely one of them. And of course, women then experience their own little bit problems in a different way, and I hope also Betty can talk more about this, because I'm afraid this women's perspective is often unrepresented when we talk about these issues. But also many of the issues West African asylum seekers encounter, they are very general for the people who are in the camps and have been stigmatized with this low perspective to stay, bleibe perspektive. Okay, so my PhD research, what I'm doing since 2016, is mostly informed by West African asylum seekers and their experiences in the asylum system. And my informants, they have some sort of final deportation order issued against them, so they have been categorized by the state as Ausreisepflichtige. And I'm looking in the work on the study how law works in action versus how the letter is law is expressing issues. So I'm interested in how law actually materially affects people's lives and how it's lived by people. And concretely, I'm asking what are the policies of the different state actors that they are using to push people out of the country to self-deport, as I say. What kind of struggles are involved in the legal status of pending deportation? Often this is called Duldung in Germany, but there are also people who don't have a Duldung who are in this situation. And also how the affected persons are themselves experiencing their situation in Germany. Therefore, resistance, contestation, and everyday survival, they are important keywords for my research. And I'm also publishing a blog called Culture of Deportation together with the Nigerian refugee activist Rex Osa from Stuttgart, where we are documenting policies that affect particularly West Africans in the German asylum system. David has been also collaborating there recently. We are documenting all these police raids and so on. And also sometimes the issue of border externalization to West Africa. So today I thought of concentrate on the issue of the police raids and security violence in the camps, which is something I encountered during my visits then to the anchor camps, or as they were called at that time, transit camps and special reception centers. This phenomenon became quite important during the last years. And then another issue is the security guard violence, where the police also has a very significant role to play, as have the courts to afterwards legitimate this, and so does the media. And just to mention that I'm also in an anti-racist trial monitoring group called Justice Watch in Berlin, where we are working together with COP, which is the campaign for the victims of...
We will always make a short break to give a German summary.
Okay.
Is that okay?
Okay, maybe I finish this introduction part. Okay, so Justice Watch is protocoling and observing court proceedings where racism is an issue. Okay.
Ich versuche es mal kurz zusammenzufassen. Aino, vielleicht ergänzt du mich auch noch, wenn du das Gefühl hast, ich vergesse was. Genau, Aino forscht zu hauptsächlich westafrikanischen Asylsuchenden, die als ausreisepflichtig, also mit abgelehnten Asylanträgen in Einrichtungen in Deutschland leben, vor allem jetzt eben in den damals Transitzentren oder ARE genannten Einrichtungen, jetzt Ankerzentren. Sie beschäftigt sich damit, wie eben die rechtliche Zuschreibung als ausreisepflichtig materiell das Leben der Menschen beeinflusst. Sie nimmt dabei sowohl die staatlichen Akteure und die staatliche Praxis von Asylverfahren, von Lagerunterbringung, von Abschiebung in den Blick, als auch Widerstand gegen Abschiebungen und Widerstand und Organisierung gegen die Lebensumstände in den Abschiebelagern in den Blick. Zusammen mit dem Genossen und Refugee-Aktivisten Rex Osa veröffentlicht sie auch gerade ein Buch, wo es eben um diese Themen geht, aber auch um die Themen von der Externalisierung der EU-Außengrenze nach Westafrika hinein.
Es ist ein Blog eigentlich. Aber
es ist ein Blog?
Ja,
okay, Entschuldigung,
mit Videos und so weiter.
Okay. Genau. Was für den heutigen Abend vor allem auch interessant ist und aktuell eben Thema sind zum einen die massiven Polizeieinsätze, die in den letzten Jahren in den Ankerzentren, also die im letzten Jahr jetzt in den Ankerzentren immer wieder vorgekommen sind und die Aino auch selber mit beobachtet hat. Und die sie auch im Rahmen von eben von Justizwatch, also von juristischer Beobachtung, von Prozessprotokollen und so weiter beobachtet und das Thema der Gewalt durch Sicherheitskräfte in den Ankerzentren.
Okay, and before going to these police raids and security violence, just a couple of words about the legal framework. I think it's important to understand the meaning of Ausreisepflicht to understand what is an anchor camp. Ausreisepflicht comes from the German immigration law. It means after a final deportation order or rejection of a permit application has been issued. This creates for the third country national, for the foreigner, a legal obligation to leave the country. And as we know, many people, for very good reasons, refuse to leave the country nevertheless. Or they simply cannot leave. Therefore, many of them are issued a so-called Duldung, toleration, which is a temporary suspension of deportation, but it's not a residency permit, so the stay is not lawful, as they say, but also should not in theory be considered a criminal offense. In practice, this is, however, a very different case. And in this situation, certain government actors, the state in the abstract, frame this as a problem of deportation gap or deportation enforcement gap. They call it Vollzugsdefizit. This is a term that comes from the Interior Ministry and all these immigration offices and these deportation hardliners. And for years, actually for decades, they've been innovating policies to push people in this so-called deportation gap to leave voluntarily because it's difficult to deport somebody who doesn't have a passport to the country of origin or to deport somebody who has a Dublin because, as we know, you can always evade it. So they've been innovating these deportation policies in the broad sense to push people to leave. For instance, work and study bans, Residenzpflicht, cutting pocket money. Also, people, of course, normally don't get proper healthcare when they are in this situation. Of Ausreisepflicht, or they just get Sachleistung and no money. And all these measures are, of course, very old. They date from the end of 70s, early 80s. So in this sense, Ankerzentren are nothing new. They are just like a new kind of formulation to this response to the same problem perceived by these government sectors. Of course, for the inhabitants, these camps create unbearable living conditions, and also they create a sort of subordinate legal status for people who are living in these camps, where many elementary, basic, and human rights are violated on a daily basis. And these violations that are of the rights that are stated in the German Constitution and international agreements are violated on the argument of on the legitimation or reasoning of public order or national security. That means border control. And here we have like a basic contradiction of the liberal democratic Rechtsstaat, German rule of law, that's so proud of guaranteeing all these rights to everybody on the territory, regardless of the immigration status, that they then nevertheless don't apply for people who come from former colonies of Europe and are then put into these camps. And just a short remark that, of course, all these border control measures affect people already before they arrive to Germany, so in the form of border externalization. Pause.
Okay. Genau, also Aino möchte erstmal den rechtlichen Rahmen für das Ganze erläutern, worüber wir sprechen. Zum einen erstmal zum Verständnis des Ganzen, eben der Term Ausreisepflicht bezieht sich darauf, dass das Asylverfahren eben endgültig abgeschlossen ist, eine Aufenthaltsgenehmigung abgelehnt worden ist und Ausreisepflicht meint die rechtliche Verpflichtung auszureisen. Praktisch kann dieser Verpflichtung von vielen Menschen aus guten Gründen nicht nachgekommen werden oder viele können einfach nicht ausreisen und fallen deshalb in den rechtlichen Status der Duldung. Die Duldung stellt an und für sich keine Aufenthaltserlaubnis dar, ist aber sozusagen erstmal eine Anerkennung der Aussetzung der Abschiebung bzw. der Nichtmöglichkeit der Ausreise gerade. Eben diesen rechtlichen Status, der wird eben von migrationspolitischen Hardlinern als eben die Vollzugslücke bei den Abschiebungen bezeichnet. Das heißt, man versucht auf diese Menschen möglichst viel Druck auszuüben, doch auszureisen. Das passiert unter anderem durch Sanktionen wie Arbeitsverbote, Kürzungen bei den Geldleistungen und eine komplette Wiederumstellung auf das Sachleistungsprinzip, also dass Leute bestimmte Sachen wie Essensleistungen als Sachleistung und nicht als Finanzleistung bekommen. Diese ganzen Maßnahmen sind an und für sich auch schon seit den späten 70er und frühen 80ern in den Schubladen der migrationspolitischen HardlinerInnen, sind also in dem Sinne nichts Neues, werden aber gerade eben momentan in den Ankerzentren sehr konzentriert angewendet. Die Leute in den Ankerzentren leben also im Endeffekt mit einem schlechter gestellten rechtlichen Status, was zu einer alltäglichen Verletzung ihrer auch verfassungsgemäßen Rechte führt. Das Ganze wird begründet mit einem Sicherheitsdiskurs, mit der Staat muss Kontrolle über seine Grenzen haben und muss da durchgreifen. Dadurch werden diese alltäglichen Rechtsverletzungen von den Menschen in den Ankerzentren begründet. Und der Kontakt mit diesen Rechtsverletzungen beginnt nicht erst in den Ankerzentren, sondern wird eben durch die Externalisierung der europäischen Außengrenze trifft es die Menschen bereits vor ihrer Ankunft in Deutschland.
Okay, and today's topic is violence, and violence is, if you talk with people who live in these camps, of course, very quotidian and affects people in these camps on a daily basis on many different levels. It's both direct physical violence, police violence or deportation, and it's also the threat of physical violence, like a deportation order, and then more structural violence, like basic rights violence and violations in the camps. What I find very useful is the concept of legal violence by two US-Mexican sociologists, Menjivar and Abrego, who define legal violence as a combination of the effects of harsh or punitive immigration laws, enforcement and policing actions, and also the negative stigmatization of immigrants. And they argue that this kind of legal violence harms immigrants both in the short and long term in ways that are easily missed by policymakers and also the general public. And I think interesting in the concept of legal violence is that it's legitimated by referring to law. Law says this, so then therefore it's okay, and it's perpetrated through law. This makes it very difficult to perceive as violence even, and to challenge. And I think to kind of get a critical picture how this violence operates, we need to talk with people who are affected by it. Because if you go to talk to a state representative, you will never understand how this works. So this is why we need the knowledge and perspective of migration. And on different levels, like knowledge of migration, of the everyday survival, organized protest. And as a special case, I would mention legal action taken by asylum seekers that against these police violence or security guard violence that produces a lot of information about how this operates. Should I go on, or I can go on?
I try to translate the first part, and maybe you have to.
Sorry, it's taking a long time.
No, it's okay. To say that last part again, because I didn't get it. Also das heutige Thema ist Gewalt in den Ankerzentren. Diese Gewalt trifft die Menschen in den Ankerzentren täglich auf unterschiedlichen Ebenen. Es gibt das Level von direkter Gewalterfahrung und Gewalterfahrung beispielsweise durch Abschiebeandrohungen, aber auch eine strukturelle Ebene von Gewalt. Eino führt dann den Begriff von Legal Violence, also rechtliche Gewalt ein, dass eben Personen durch die systematische Schlechterstellung von Asylsuchenden und die systematische Diskriminierung eben permanent einer Gewalterfahrung ausgesetzt sind. Und dass diese Gewalterfahrung auch eben nur von den Betroffenen selbst wiedergegeben werden kann, weshalb sie auch die Wichtigkeit eben von Forschung mit den Betroffenen selber betont, weil nur aus deren Perspektive eben das herausgearbeitet werden kann. Und man beispielsweise jetzt, wenn man mit staatlichen Stellen oder so spricht, diese Gewalt überhaupt nicht sichtbar gemacht werden kann.
Okay, ja, also es setzt sich eigentlich zusammen von Gesetze, dann Vollzugebene und dann auch Medien und Stigmatisierung und so weiter. Ja, okay. Criminalization is important logic within the legal violence, and it's also central in the anger camps as among the policies to push people to leave the country. And there's many levels of criminalization. There is, of course, the so-called immigration offenses, penalizing people who should not be here as they are framed, or also depriving people of all means of subsistence so that they have to work illegally or steal or sell drugs or to survive. And also criminalization by stigmatization in the media, or also by leaving them without any documents, like they do nowadays in Bamberg, for instance. They don't give you dulung or anything. And the large-scale, spectacular police raids in the camps are a recent innovation or formula for criminalizing asylum seekers also. And they now operate as part of this deportation policy package in the broader sense. And the background to these raids is, as we know, that since 2017, the Bavarian police law has been amended and defining now all asylum camps as dangerous places where the police can enter anytime without any further authorization to perform controls. And this has enabled the practice of large-scale police raids, of which there has been hundreds since 2017. Many of these raids have been, from the outset, been unlawful laws, as they say, having no special grounds. But then different excuses have been also presented at some point before, after, during of these raids to send hundreds of armed officers in riot gear and with dogs and so on to, for instance, remove illicit fridges, as they said in Waldkreiburg in summer 2018, or bread knives in Donauwörth summer 2018, or water cookers and CD players. This happened in Fürstenfeldbruck in November 2018, where also almost 300 officers, I think, entered. And in many cases, deportation was also directly an issue, most prominently so in Donauwörth a year ago and a couple of days. This was March 14th, 2018, in Elwangen, May of the same year. But also in Stephansbosching, Deggendorf or Schweinfurt, and also Donaueschingen in Baden-Württemberg. There was a specific pattern repeating after a failed Dublin deportation attempt. A day or some days later, police attacked the camp. There were arrests, court cases, and asylum seekers got criminalized. Regardless of the excuse for the raid, the general effect of these raids has been intimidation and great fear among residents of the camps. People have been later leaving en masse to other countries. And on the other hand, these raids have also sent messages to the larger public, the voters, to get some support for these hardliner asylum policies and camp policies. The figure and visual representation of the black African criminal asylum seeker became particularly prominent in the moral panic around Elwangen, but also on a more regional and local level in these other cases, it has been spreading the same racist stigmatization after each raid. And this went actually so far as to portray the African male asylum seeker as the enemy of the state or enemy of the Rechtsstaat for the mere reason of being here. We all have seen these images of handcuffed people and so on, being accompanied by the police. But rather than the model of Rechtsstaat, rule of law, these raids actually follow a model of police violence, which creates law as it enforces it. And
these raids typically, as I said, have started without any specific reason, then except that asylum camps are dangerous places, then and asylum seekers are security risk. Then police entering the camp produces the legitimation as it goes on, and also afterwards the courts help in producing this legitimation. The courts have in general had an important role in afterwards criminalizing the refugees, the victims of these raids, and legitimizing the police actions. In Elvangen we saw, of course, now recently that also you can, a protest can force the court to recognize some of the basic rights of the people. In that case, inviolability of the home, you cannot enter somebody's home without legal order. They didn't have this in Elvangen. Of course, in Bayern, the police law allows entering refugee homes without any order. But anyway, at the same time, also in Elvangen, with this victory, you're seeing at the same time that the police is trying to invent more reasons for the raid and starting to issue actually arrest orders against people on the night of the failed deportation. Okay.
Okay. Genau. Ich versuche nochmal zu übersetzen. Die Kriminalisierung ist ein entscheidender Faktor bei der strukturellen Gewalt gegen Geflüchtete in den Ankerzentren. Kriminalisierung erfolgt auf verschiedenen Wegen. Zum einen werden Leute für die Tatsache ihrer Migration an und für sich kriminalisiert. Das heißt, es gibt beispielsweise den Vorwurf der illegalen Einreise, Residenzpflichtverletzungen oder ähnliche sich aus der Migration selber ergebende Vergehen. Weiterhin werden die Leute auch kriminalisiert, indem die Lebensgrundlage so knapp bemessen wird und die Möglichkeit genommen wird, selber zu arbeiten. Dadurch werden Leute in illegale Beschäftigung gedrängt oder in Dinge wie Drogenhandel gedrängt. Weiterhin werden Leute auch dadurch kriminalisiert, dass zum Teil gar keine Dokumente mehr ausgegeben werden, wie das beispielsweise in Bamberg jetzt der Fall ist. Und ein entscheidender öffentlicher Faktor der Kriminalisierung waren im letzten Jahr eben auch die massiven Polizeieinsätze gegen Ankerzentren und in Ankerzentren. In Bayern ist ja bekanntermaßen 2017 das Polizeiaufgabengesetz reformiert worden und Geflüchtetenunterkünfte als gefährliche Orte definiert. Das heißt, die Polizei darf dort jetzt anlasslos Kontrollen durchführen. Es gab dementsprechend dann auch hunderte von solchen Einsätzen, die teilweise anlasslos stattfanden oder mit Ausreden oder Ausflüchten wie dass Wasserkocher oder so in Zimmern seien, sind dann eben Einsätze mit hunderten PolizistInnen in schwerer Montur und mit Hunden in diesen Zentren durchgeführt worden. Oft auch im Zusammenhang mit Abschiebungen oder Abschiebeversuchen, wie das beispielsweise bei einem der bekanntesten Fälle in Elvangen der Fall war. Bei diesen Polizeieinsätzen kommt es dann wiederum zu Festnahmen und im Nachgang häufig auch zu Anklagen und Gerichtsprozessen gegen Insassen aus den Ankerzentren. Und unabhängig davon, was die Anlässe offiziell sind, der Effekt ist zum einen auf jeden Fall, dass die BewohnerInnen von Ankerzentren in ständiger Angst vor solchen Einsätzen leben, was auch dazu führt, dass viele Leute aus den Ankerzentren in andere Länder weiter geflohen sind. Und es ist, sendet auch eine Nachricht an die Öffentlichkeit und an migrationspolitische Hardliner. Es wird öffentlich einfach die Figur des kriminellen, schwarzen, männlichen Asylsuchenden immer wieder reproduziert. Und die Logik von diesen Einsätzen folgt nicht dem Modell eines Rechtsstaats, sondern folgt dem Modell von Polizeigewalt. Das heißt, die Einsätze selbst erzeugen eigentlich das Recht, erzeugen die Anlässe dafür. Und auch die Gerichte spielen dabei eine Rolle, wenn im Nachgang Personen angeklagt werden für beispielsweise Widerstand gegen diese Polizeieinsätze. In Elvangen gab es jetzt ein Urteil, dass, wo die Widerstandsanklagen gegen die Betroffenen fallen gelassen worden sind, weil eben die Polizeimaßnahme an und für sich nicht als rechtmäßig vom Gericht anerkannt wurde. In Bayern ist die Situation aber eben, wie Aino meinte, mit dem Polizeiaufgabengesetz eine andere.
Okay, Erlangen ist noch nicht ein Urteil, aber es ist schon ein Stand genommen von der, vom Gericht. Okay, as I said, legal action taken by the victims of these raids and support campaigns, they are crucial for bringing information to light about these raids. Otherwise, we would have not too much information what actually happened, and also to raise awareness and to keep up some public pressure on these issues, because otherwise they would just be normalized as they are being normalized. And I unfortunately cannot go in detail to any of these cases. David can maybe tell later, I hope, something about the Donavad case. There we will have the next hearing on the 6th of May coming out. But I would just shortly like to talk about the Bamberg security complex, because there's nobody in the podium to talk about it, and I think it's really important. Security guard violence in these anchor camps seems to be pervasive, like everywhere. And Bamberg is like a very kind of paradigmatic case about this, because there it has been very systematic how the security company created a so-called special team, a Sonder team, in the summer 2017, which officially was supposed to de-escalate conflicts when they happened, but unofficially, actually, what they were doing was to provocate and beat up black African males. I have not been talking about too much with women. I suppose they have also experienced a lot of problems with these securities, but I've been talking about a lot with male victims. And what I wanted to say, only, many of the victims, they got later a strafefehl and had to pay, or also many of them left the country because they were totally demoralized by this troop of securities. And there were only a couple of cases where the victims, they made Einspruch, and then we as Justice Watch and some other groups joined the support campaign. And this is also how we it was revealed that this is actually a complex of many, many different cases. And we also found out that there has been criminal investigations against certain securities there. And unfortunately, these files are very, very... how do you say, they are very large files, the investigations against these securities, but they have been closed since last fall, and now we are really thinking how to reopen these cases, because the same pattern of the Sonder team, the special team violence, has been repeating again, even after these investigations were started and the suspects were suspended from their jobs. Last December, there was another incident where securities entered a room of Eritreans and beat one of them until he was bleeding on the floor, and he lost also some teeth. And after that, over 100 police officers came to aid those securities and arrested 16 refugees, and some of them are still in pre-trial custody. And during this raid, also the securities helped the police to handcuff people. They were beating refugees in the presence of police. So in this case, we see quite well how actually securities and are sort of outsourced police force and are working very closely in collaboration with the police. And this is not the single case. In Donauwörth, there's been also a similar kind of collaboration with the securities and the police. And until now in Bamberg, the court really refuses to look into these crimes, and the system is still working. I will stop also here.
Okay, genau. Dass die Betroffenen von dieser Gewalt Rechtsmittel einlegen, dass Prozesse beobachtet werden, dass es Support-Kampagnen dafür gibt, ist eben extrem wichtig, um das Ganze an die Öffentlichkeit zu bringen und auch um diese strukturelle Gewalt zu benennen und aufzudecken. Einer wollte dann noch die Fälle von Security-Gewalt bzw. das System von Gewalt durch Sicherheitsdienste im Ankerzentrum Bamberg als sozusagen paradigmatisches Beispiel für die Gewalt von Sicherheitsdiensten anführen. In dem Ankerzentrum dort wurden sogenannte Sondereinheiten bei der Security gebildet, deren formale Aufgabe war, die Kommunikation mit den BewohnerInnen zu übernehmen, die aber deren tatsächliche Aufgabe oder Betätigungsfeld dann darin bestand, männliche schwarze Geflüchtete anzugreifen und zusammenzuschlagen. Häufig gab es im Nachgang nach solchen Vorfällen dann Strafbefehle gegen die Opfer von diesen gewalttätigen Aktionen und es gab nur sehr selten Einsprüche gegen die Strafbefehle. Wenn das der Fall war, ist Justizwatch dann eben aktiv geworden und hat dort Soli-Kampagnen unterstützt. Und es gibt also eine größere Menge an Fällen und Akten, die diese Vorfälle belegen. Die wurden aber von den Gerichten in Bamberg geschlossen. Die betroffenen Mitarbeiter der Sicherheitsfirmen wurden entlassen. Es gibt aber jetzt wieder neue Fälle. Unter anderem wurde ein eritreischer Geflüchteter in seinem Zimmer von Securities zusammengeschlagen und verletzt, woraufhin es einen Einsatz mit über 100 PolizistInnen gab, bei dem dann die Security und die Polizei sozusagen gemeinsam Personenhandschellen angelegt haben, es weiterhin zu Gewalt durch Securities kam. Also es gab eine Kollaboration zwischen den privaten Sicherheitskräften im Ankerzentrum und der Polizei. Und Ähnliches wurde auch in Donauwörth beobachtet. Vielen Dank für die
Einführung. Yeah, thank you. And sorry for taking so much time, but unfortunately with the translation takes. Thank you for the translation.
Okay, thanks a lot for the overview. We will now. We will now go into the discussion and hear more from the personal experiences the three people here have and also out of the audience. The first topic we want to focus on is like, how is daily life in these camps? How does this structure of the camps, of these huge camps, affect the people? And how does it make life difficult for them? And I would like to ask you, Betty, first about your experiences. You are a woman, you are a mother. How is the situation for you in the camp, especially with a small kid? How would you describe the problems you are facing every day?
Hello, everyone. I'm from the ACA Center in Ingolstadt. So it's really kind of difficult for us, especially with the mothers. It's difficult because the children, I gave birth to my baby last year, and she's a year old now, but she had to be in kindergarten, but there's no opportunity for them because they can't do it. They don't go to kindergarten, they stay with us at home, and it's really difficult for us because why? We are not secured. Because we are in the room whereby with the kids and with other people in the room, maybe 4 to 5 people in one room, with children, little children. And it's really hard for us. Because, and secondly, the way we feed them, the living, the way we feed them is kind of difficult because we can't sterilize their feeding bottles. We can't refrigerate their food. And it's difficult for us. And the environment is hurtful. So as the children, they have to go to school.
So, and sorry, for example, how would you do if you have to prepare a bottle for your kids? How can you do that?
For the kids, for we to prepare the bottle food for them, on a normal note, we have to have the warmer, which we have to warm the bottle food. But now, I have to open the bottle food and put it inside the feeding bottle and add hot water then I have to shake it and give it to my baby. If not, she can't use, she can't eat the warm food.
Okay, and do you have access to all these sterilizing things and hot water in your room, or how do you get this kind of things?
For the sterilizing of the bottles and other things, we don't have it.
Okay.
And for the hot water, before we have the access, even the boiler we are using, we have to hide it. Because if they should get hold of it, they will seize it. And then if you try to make them understand that these are for the children, they have to have made problem with you for it. Because they will keep saying it's not allowed. Then if it is not allowed, how do we make food for the kids? How do we make hot water? You don't expect us, because they have to put the tap water in the warming machine downstairs. So they put the tap water in. You don't expect me to use a tap water for my baby. So we have this, because if they are coming, maybe they want to check the room, we have to hide the boiler, or for the sake for us to get warm water for our kids. So it's really, really difficult for us. It's difficult.
Yeah, so I think from the experience we have, this was one of the reasons they gave for one of the big police raids in Fürstenfeldbruck, that most of the women had water cookers for their babies. So that is a very difficult situation. Could you explain a little bit more about the security of women in the camp? How do you feel? Like, do you have a room where you can be safe? How is the situation with the securities? Like, usually when we talk to the government will say, okay, for the houses of women, they will put extra securities so the women can feel more safe. Is that the fact, or how do you feel about that?
About the security of the women is it's not secured. We are not secured because, one, when we want to sleep, we can't lock our rooms. We don't have the access to it. We sleep with our doors open. Anybody can barge in. Anybody can come in at the middle of the night and just open your door and do anything drastic to you. We are not secured as women. In the camp, in the food camp, if you come to our camp in Ingolstadt, no one has the key to his or her room. And in the rooms, we are more than 2-3 in one room. So we are not secured. Even they give you the security, they make problems with us. And the aspect of maybe you're having your shower in the bedroom, a security has to come and open the door of the bedroom and start looking at you as a woman. When you complain, the police, they won't even support you. They won't even ask you questions. All they have to do is to support the security. So we are not safe. We are not.
How would you say is the medical situation, especially with small kids? How would you say is it when you need medical care for your kid? How about emergencies? Do you have any experiences with that?
Yeah, I had an experience with that. When my baby was sick, I went to the social workers who take care of us, and I asked them, please, can you call the ambulance for me? I think it was after 9 in the night. And all she could tell me was that, sorry, I can't call the ambulance. And I was like, my baby is sick, and I'm worried, and you're asking me to wait in tomorrow morning? How is that possible? So that I have to take my baby in the middle of the night and take her to the hospital by myself. And I have to come back by 1 p.m. in the middle of the night, back home. So when you complain to them that your baby is sick, is that, they ask you to go see the camp doctor. And when you get there, you have to queue. And sometimes it won't even get to your turn. And all they can tell you that you go see the outside doctor. But before you go see the outside doctor, you have to book an appointment, which is really, really difficult for us. The medical aspect is poor. It's poor in the camp.
Okay, thanks a lot for your explanations. We would now allow questions or comments out of the audience. So if any of the other inhabitants of the camps have some experience to add to that, like now about the general living conditions, or if someone has questions, please raise your hand. then we will allow a few questions and comments, and then we will go to the next topic. Would you come to the front?
Good evening, everyone. I also want to add to what my sister said, especially about the medical condition and the security in my place. It is very poor. Like last month, I was very sick because I had this painful stomach ache. I was rolling on the floor. They are all here. My friends are here. I was rolling. I was crying like a baby. They called the social worker to come and see that I'm crying and I'm not feeling fine. They asked the social worker to call the ambulance. They said they would call the ambulance. They left. 2 hours I was on the floor. I was still crying. They were waiting for the ambulance. They said ambulance is coming. We didn't even know that they didn't call the ambulance. We had to call the ambulance by ourselves. They said that they cannot call the ambulance until you get to the stage that maybe if I faint or I'm almost at the point of death where I cannot breathe, that's the only way they can call the ambulance. You understand? So that's what they do in our camp. And it's very bad. So many people are dead. They are very sick, but they know that they won't call the ambulance for them. So they are like my baby. Now my baby is not feeling too strong because it's bringing out tooth. If I go to the doctor now to give me medicine, they say there's no medicine, it's normal. But at night, it does not sleep because his body is very hot. No paracetamol, no medicine for the tooth, for the pain. And in the aspect of the security, of recent, if we are baiting, they will just barge into the bathroom to see you. And when you try to confront them, then they will gather together to beat the person. Like it happened to a lady in our camp. We gathered together as women to like ask them, this is a woman bathroom. It's written in Dutch and in English. So you can't say you don't know how to read Dutch or English. So what are you doing there without knocking? He said he wanted to check if everything is okay. Inside the bathroom, there was no noise. Nobody was fighting. The alarm was not ringing.
So a male security.
Yes. The alarm was not ringing. So what are you going to check there if everything is okay? We were like trying to explain to the other security. They were laughing at us. They didn't take it serious. Even when the police came, the only thing the police said was the security should apologize to the woman. That's all they can do. And they've done it to like more than 7 people in our camp. You understand?
Okay. Thanks a lot for the insight.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Are there more people who want to add something or ask something to this topic? Okay, then we will move on to the next topic, that is like the situation in the camps with the security and with the police. So all of you had experiences with that, so I would like to ask you, Javid, to give us a insight of what is your experience with security and police in your camp at the moment.
Good evening, everyone. I'm very, very happy for this opportunity to speak, especially with crowd like this. Even if it's not going to bring anything, but at least it gladdens my heart that a lot of people like this knows our pain, not only me, but each every one of us that are here, especially blacks. In terms of security and policing in our camps, because I was opportunity to be in Ingolstadt before I was transferred to Volkersen here in Munich. The kind of security that we have, I believe that each security that are in various camps, I think they have something they normally tell them before they come to our camps. Because you can't tell me that a man will just come and explain something to you, at the end of the day, it will turn back at you. In my camp, if you go to any social worker to say, please, the bottle food that you need to give to my baby, I don't need this because it's not good for her or it's not good for him. The social worker will tell you, you have to give him or you have to give her. But you tell them, this food is not good for my baby. He will say, nothing he can do that, but you just have to give the food to your baby. But when you try to confront them, then they will call the police on you. Then the worst thing is, when the police come, they won't call you to say, what happened? Explain what happened. They will just be looking at you. Then they will just listen to the social workers. Then anything, they will just tell them in German or in whatever language they know will not understand. Then the next thing, police will say, okay, because of this, they have brought a letter for you to be transferred to maybe Bamberg or Ingolstadt or Festa Facebook. Then when you say no, that you can't go, the next thing is for them to beat you up. So this thing happened, I think, about 3 weeks. 3 weeks ago, a boy and a girl, you know, it happens when something cuts the woman's leg. Then the woman has to meet the social worker to explain things to them that this leg is swollen. Please, I need an ambulance or take me to a hospital so they can treat this leg. But for the woman to say, okay, I can't, or go to the hospital yourself, the woman was like, you are rude. You should have talked to me politely. The way you talk to me, I don't like it. So because of this, I've called my boss, and my boss asked me to transfer you to Ingolstadt. The boy was like, even if I'm rude, that doesn't mean you shouldn't treat my wife's leg. He said that's not his business, and you have to go to Ingolstadt. The boy said no, and they called the police. But when the police came, what did they do? Nothing. When the boy refused to go, they beat this boy and the wife. Wife was even pregnant. They beat both of them. They even shocked them with electric. Two of them. And the two of them collapsed before they were taken away. So this is not something that I heard. I saw it. I videoed it. Everything is with me. But when you try to come, even we that are here, if tomorrow you hear, oh, this person go to that protest, then you are marked for something. Either they transfer you to one dead village, or when you go to AS51 to renew your advice, they will tell you your advice is no more reading. And the next thing, Germany said you should go back to Italy, or they want to deport you, or one thing or the other. So all these things, I think, is not something that they just generate themselves. But I believe these things, anytime they want to transfer any security man to any camp, they always tell them, this is what you will do. But the police issue is, they said they are protecting lives. They protect properties, children, and all. But in our own case, I think is turned around. Because if they said they are protecting lives, I can't believe that a policeman, you are not, even if you are a criminal, even if I hold a gun on my hand, a policeman cannot just see me and shoot me. No. It must ask a question. It must have something to say, oh, this person is wrong or not. But in our case, when they come, if they say, do this, and you say no, the next thing is to beat you up and lock you in the room.
So actually, there is no authority or no one you can approach if you are having problems or if you are having conflicts or fear. There's no one you can approach.
No one you will talk to. Even if you go to House 51 or you go to Banff, they will tell you, okay, don't worry, go, we have heard, we'll look into the case. They will never look into the case.
Okay, thanks a lot. David, you also have some experience with security and police in the camp you have been before. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? How the situation was and how you feel about the connection between security and police and this relation to the security?
Thank you very much. good evening once again and welcome again. We believe the connections between the police and the securities in the camps are very, very strong, because whatever happened within the camp, it is the securities that see the actions, or probably the security that acts on the actions and then accuse the refugees about what had happened. But then at the end of the day, it will be the security again who will call the police. And when the police come, they don't normally ask questions, but rather they will just take you and either lock you or give you a strap. And then, like, sometimes it's not actually locking, but then keeping you in the police station for a day or two, released you and give you a strafe. But in our case, we've had quite a lot of time, quite a lot of experience whereby securities will just have an agreement with a refugee, and then the refugee is being beaten. And the beating is not just like one security beating a refugee, but rather the security who is having the argument will just call on their phone, the walkie-talkie, and a large number of securities will come. They will pin the refugee on the ground. Some will be on the head, others on the body, others on the leg, on the legs, and they will beat the individual seriously to their satisfaction, and then make a call, and the police will just come. Either the refugee is wounded or not wounded, they will just arrest the refugee, and then nothing is done about that. And that is the connection that we have, we realize between police and the refugees.
Okay, thanks a lot for your perspective as well and for your information. I just realized we forgot for a long time to translate, so we will give a short German summary of what has been talked now, and then we will continue.
Also in dem ersten Teil ging es darum, also die, ich habe dein, I forgot your name, what is your name? Okay, Betty hat erzählt, sie wohnt im Moment in Ingolstadt und die Situation für sie ist dort besonders schwer, auch besonders schwer für die Kinder und für Mütter mit Kindern. Also es ging dann darum, wie schwierig es ist, für die Mütter oder für die Eltern ihre Kinder zu ernähren, dass Kinder auch nicht zur Schule gehen. Rebecca hat nochmal nachgefragt, wie genau sie denn zum Beispiel Flaschen aufwärmen können für Babys. Dann wurde gesagt, es gibt keine Sterilisierungsgeräte und dass sie Wasserkocher in ihren Zimmern haben, die sie auch verstecken müssen, denn diese sind nicht erlaubt. Es gibt so Heißwasserspender, aber die wollen sie nicht benutzen, weil sie dem Wasser auch nicht vertrauen, sondern sie wollen das Wasser kochen. Und wenn also Zimmerkontrollen passieren, dann kann es sein, dass diese Wasserkocher einbehalten werden. Sie wissen aber nicht, wie sie sozusagen die Flaschen zubereiten sollen, ohne die Wasserkocher. Das war auch mal ein Beispiel eben für so einen Polizeieinsatz, als die Wasserkocher als Grund genutzt wurden für so einen riesen Polizeieinsatz. Dann ging es um die Situation der Frauen bzw. die Sicherheit von Frauen. Es wurde gefragt, ob denn diese Sicherheitsdienste, die Security zu einer Sicherheit führen oder nicht. Die Betty hat gesagt, nein, sie fühlt sich nicht sicher. Es gibt keine Sicherheit in den Lagern. Die Zimmer sind immer offen, sie sind nicht abschließbar. Das heißt, jeder kann jederzeit reinkommen ins Zimmer und sie fühlt sich nicht durch die Security geschützt, sondern sie hat eher das Gefühl auch, dass die, wenn zum Beispiel Polizei noch kommt oder hinzugeführt wird, dass die Security schützen und nicht die Menschen in dem Lager geschützt sind. Die medizinische Versorgung war dann noch ein Thema. Es ging darum, dass nicht sofort ein Krankenwagen gerufen wird, wenn die Eltern danach verlangen. Also sie hat zum Beispiel mal gesagt, ihr Kind ist krank, ob bitte ein Krankenwagen gerufen werden kann. Das wurde aber verneint. Und sie musste dann selbst ins Krankenhaus eben gehen mit ihrem Kind, obwohl sie nicht wusste, was los ist. Es gibt auch einen Camparzt, also im Lager gibt es einen eigenen Arzt, dort ist aber immer eine lange Schlange und Termine zu bekommen außerhalb ist sehr schwer für die Menschen. Also ist die generelle Situation sehr, sehr schlecht. Zusätzlich hat dann noch eine Frau aus dem Publikum gesagt, die dort auch wohnt. Auch sie hatte mal sehr, sehr starke Bauchschmerzen, hatte darum gebeten, dass ein Arzt gerufen wird. Es hat 2 Stunden gedauert, bis sie überhaupt verstanden hat, dass überhaupt kein Arzt gerufen wurde. Der wurde dann von anderen Leuten, Freunden, so wie ich es verstanden habe, angerufen oder auch ein Problem. Zum Beispiel, wenn sich Leute oder Frauen versammeln und dann sagen, hey, hier stimmt irgendwas nicht oder das stört uns, dann wird häufig die Polizei hinzugezogen, auch bei Situationen, wo zum Beispiel der Sicherheitsdienst einfach in die sanitären Anlagen, also in die Duschen, in die Bäder reingeht, die eigentlich nur für Frauen sind, die sagen dann, sie wollen kontrollieren. Die Frauen fühlen sich davon gestört und sie fühlen sich auch nicht ernst genommen.
Genau, ich würde ganz kurz noch zusammenfassen, was John und David gesagt haben. John war zuerst auch in dem Ankerzentrum in Ingolstadt-Manching und ist jetzt in der Funkkaserne in München. Er sagt, dass viele Leute der hier Anwesenden ja auch die Probleme in den Camps kennen. Da spricht er eben auch über die Polizeieinsätze, dass wenn die Polizei kommt, eigentlich immer nur die Sicht der SozialarbeiterInnen oder der Securities gehört wird und sie gar nicht gefragt werden, was denn passiert ist und es bei diesen Polizeieinsätzen auch häufig zu Gewalt gegen Geflüchtete kommt. Er meinte auch noch, dass der Transfer als ständige Drohung im Raum steht, falls Leute sich in irgendeiner Form nicht kooperativ verhalten. Er hat auch noch eine Geschichte erzählt, wo eben jemand sich über die medizinische Behandlung seiner Frau beschwert hat und ihm dann er auch dann sofort als Strafe in ein anderes Lager transferiert wurde. Wenn sich Leute dagegen wehren, kommt eben auch dann die Polizei. John meinte auch noch, dass es kein zufälliges Verhalten von Einzelpersonen so ist, sondern dass die Securities ganz bewusst so instruiert werden, ganz bewusst so eingesetzt werden und dass es eine bewusste und strukturelle Gewalt durch die Securities ist. David, der im Ankerzentrum in Donauwörth gelebt hat, erzählt eben Ähnliches, dass Securities und Sicherheitsdienste bei Streitereien dann oft die Polizei selber verständigen und dass die Polizei ankommt, keine Fragen stellt, sondern eigentlich immer die Person, die das Opfer in der Auseinandersetzung wurde, die Geflüchteten mitnimmt und diese dann häufig auch noch eine Strafe bekommen. Wenn es zu Streit zwischen einem Bewohner in einem Lager und dem Sicherheitsdienst kommt, wird immer sehr schnell Verstärkung von den Sicherheitsdiensten gerufen. Diese attackieren dann die Geflüchteten, oft auch eben aus bewusster Freude daran oder Bosheit, wie David meinte. Und später wird dann eben die Polizei gerufen.
Okay, vielen Dank. So now we would say, we would open it to the audience again to either give your own experiences or ask questions if you have particular questions on this topic of security and police in the camps. So one person over here.
My interest is not primarily for the situation, police and security, but my interest is more the medical care about the children. You know, we have here in Munich the Funkkaserne, 250 persons are living there, 80 children, yes? And it is a scandal that the care about these children is not up, it's terrible, that's the problem. But it's not a medical problem, it is a social problem. And for this, the city of Munich, it's her job to keep for the children. So my interest would be, what is your name? No. What? John, how long are you now living in Funkkaserne?
11 months.
11 months. What is your impression about the medical care about children?
Yeah, the medical care about the children in Funkkaserne, for me, because, you know, everybody has his own experience, but for the one I've experienced with my own son, because my wife gave birth in that camp, You know, anytime he always falls sick, all the time, he always falls sick. And when you take him to the medical, the